Well, the 21st century celebrated its 20th birthday last week. As we're now one-fifth of the way through the century, what lies ahead? We won't try to predict the whole century, but we have some inklings as to the important stories of 2020, and in many cases those inklings come from the issues we dealt with in 2019. That's our focus this morning on the West Side. And good morning, I'm Dean Kallenbach. Our guests today include Lisa Patro. She's the news director for WEAU-TV, Channel 13 in Eau Claire. Lisa Patro, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning.
Gary Johnson's also with us. He's the editor of the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram. Gary Johnson, good to have you.
Good morning, Dean.
And Rich Kramer back in the seat here at Wisconsin Public Radio. He's Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Eau Claire. Good to have you along this morning, Rich.
Great to be here.
We'll be weighing in on what we think are the big stories, but we're counting on you to contribute your ideas as well. Maybe it's something that was important but didn't get the coverage you think it should have. Let us know. It's your chance. For anyone wishing to comment or ask a question of our guests, call 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. So a lot of the stories we'll be talking about today affect many, if not most, people in western Wisconsin. But Gary Johnson, the story that topped the Leader Telegram's list is a very specific crime story, Jamie Kloss.
Yes. It was a pretty obvious one, I think. I mean, given all the local, state, national attention it received, certainly it was a story where I think people really were captured by it because there was this young girl in a presumably safe, small town in Wisconsin suddenly just disappears and without a trace. I mean, doesn't seem to be any connection with anything with the parents who tragically died at the same time. And it was just, I don't think anybody had a really good feeling that this would have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And it turns out it did.
And of course, this was a big story in 2018, which is when the murder of Jamie Kloss' parents happened and outside of Barron. Jamie herself disappeared and people searched for her for many, many months. And then the story of 2019 was her escape in January, and then later the arrest and conviction of the individual, Jake Patterson, who was the person who perpetrated those crimes. And Rich Kramer, you spent a lot of time in Barron covering the Jamie Kloss story from the beginning. Talk about the impact of Jamie's escape a year ago this week, by the way, and later the conviction and sentencing of Jake Patterson. What effect all that had on the people you talked to in the community?
Holy smokes, I didn't realize it was a year ago this week.
Yeah, January 10th.
Right. Well, I mean, every time I was up there, every time I've been up there, people have brought up Jamie Kloss one way or the other. I mean, because Gary mentioned, it just hit everybody really deeply. You know, everyone's got family, you know, everyone, maybe they have kids, maybe they have a cousin, you know, everyone knows someone of that age. And also just the strange, there were so many theories, but when she was found, there wasn't any kind of giant rally or anything, but the whole community seemed to breathe a sigh of relief. I wasn't there. I just wish I could have been there to get the audio of this, but I guess there were some high school basketball games going on, and they announced it over the loudspeaker, and everyone went nuts. So, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, oh, that'd be great natural sound.
Sure.
But that was just the beginning of a lot of relief. And so people didn't really feel safe. I mean, they were telling me that, I heard many times that people were checking their garages. You know, they were looking their property over because it was just so unusual that some heinous crime like this would happen, a double murder and then a kidnapping. And then she was just gone without a trace for 88 days.
Yeah, the murder of Jamie's parents, her kidnapping, her escape, all had a direct effect on their family or friends or neighbors. And that impact was life-changing for those people. And as Rich mentioned, those neighbors feeling a little, you know, less safe than they maybe had the day before. But really the day-to-day effect of those incidents on the rest of us in western Wisconsin was little, if any. So Lisa Patro, why did this story, and particularly the story of Jamie's escape, not only make the top of your newscast at TV 13, it also led the national network news shows that day?
Well, I think there's just as kind of Rich alluded to as well, you know, everyone knows a young person. And I think it reminded us of some of the stories from the past that had been success stories that, although these young gals had gone through a lot, the J.C. Dugards,
Elizabeth Smart,
yeah. You know. So I think they're few and far between, but I mean, the girls did come home safe and they came home alive. They went through terrible ordeals, as did Jamie. But I think everyone was holding out hope, and you saw it in the volunteers that came from out of state and everywhere. I think that the Barron County Sheriff's Department did a wonderful job handling it. I know in the early days, there was some speculation and there was some false information out there. She'd been spotted in Miami, and that turned out to be absolutely nothing. And I think that Chris Fitzgerald did a good job of saying, I'm the point person. I'm the person that's going to, you know, if you have any information, you come to me. And if it's something that checks out, I'll let you know. But I do think it captured the nation, too, just because it was such a mystery. Yeah. There were no clues. You know, her parents were gone and there were no clues. Where did she go? Who took her? Where is she? And there was just really nothing to go on for a very long time.
Yeah. And it turned out that she herself ended up, you know,
saving herself,
creating the escape, which is another, you know, interesting aspect of that story.
I think there's something that was really interesting about it was that everybody knew the name Jamie Kloss. I mean, I'd have friends who would text me from Madison and other parts of the country who would say, so what's up with it? Or when she was found. And also, I think the fact that it never really went away, the topic never went away. Like Lisa said, the organized searches and the Christmas lightings and the billboards. And like when she was discovered by the woman out walking her dog, she immediately knew who Jamie Kloss was.
Sure.
And when they went to that house to get safety, they immediately knew. All I had to say was Jamie Kloss, and like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Call 911. I mean.
And I don't, you know, this is kind of, this isn't hard news by any stretch or by any standard, but, you know, you also had a kind of a local celebrity up there who brought up.
Chris Cruzy.
Yeah, Chris Cruzy, when he was on that nationwide TV show, he used that platform to talk about Jamie Kloss and raise awareness. So that by itself was something that, you know, Barron's not used to.
Yeah, Barron got more than its 15 minutes of fame here in the last year and a half or so.
They've been through a lot.
Speaking of Barron, we'll talk about that in a second. I do want to remind people you can call with your ideas of the top stories of 2019 or what you think is going to be a big story in 2020, 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615. There were a few weather stories that caused significant damage this summer, including a tornado in Ross County near Bruce in early July, huge wind event in Barron County that took down thousands of trees, and an EF3 tornado that resulted in a state of emergency in Chippewa, Clark, and Dunn counties in September. Rich Kramer, I know you spent some time surveying some of that damage for WPR.
Yeah, it was a crazy summer. And there were some stories, you know, everyone's looking for year-end stories and look-backs and all that, so I saw something, the National Weather Service said there were 21 tornadoes in 2019. Going back, July 20th was that weekend, there was the big windstorm that went through. When I went up to Barron, it looked like straight line sort of winds, but it was really something. The whole downtown was just destroyed. I mean, any tree that was, you know, more than 10-15 feet tall was snapped off. Big pine trees, you know, Barron had a lot of beautiful pine trees. The other thing that struck me was a flagpole was bent, like, you know, 15 degrees because the wind was so strong, just the resistance on the flag. And, you know, I looked back at some of our reporting, too, at WPR. I mean, that weekend, at least 186,000 people across the entire state had lost power. And then, of course, in September, the tornado that touched down near Elk Mound. I mean, anytime I go to these sites, it's always, it's just twists your guts because these people are standing in the rubble of what used to be their house, and you're climbing through it to ask them questions. But people are really gracious. They understand that you've got a job to do. And the one woman that I spoke to, this was right near Highway 29 where the tornado kind of crossed over. She said, "This will not define me," this woman told me. So that was really interesting. But EF3, I mean, not long ago we had a tornado that killed one person in Chetek, but that one wasn't even as powerful as the one that hit last September. So just some wild weather.
It does go to show you how devastating, though, those straight-line winds can be. Even tornadoes aside, I think one thing, you know, when you were talking about news coverage, we went up there a lot too, and I think something that's been, you know, a good resource for us, let's face it, nobody has the resources to have a chopper in western Wisconsin at their disposal, but, you know, I think, you know, a lot of us have drones now, and that's really been something that has allowed us to show viewers the scope of the damage, as opposed to, you know, you see a storm story, and how does it always start? Yeah. Well, with a chainsaw. And then, you know, we show just snapshots. Well, here we're able to show the entire landscape or take it for, you know, miles. And so I think that's something that this past year in particular, we were really able to show the scope of what these storms do.
Yeah, you talk about that. And I was sharing with you, way back a long time ago, back in the mid-80s, I was an assignment editor for a television station in Wausau, and we would rent a chopper for a story like that, but it was, you know, high cost, and boy, we just didn't want to do that every day. Mm-hmm. And to be able to use a drone and get those same sort of shots and be able to manage that and control that, I bet that's really important. You know, Lisa, weather's always been an emphasis for local television stations. You folks basically have the working meteorologists in the city of Eau Claire. Was there anything particularly challenging for your staff when it came to either covering or predicting the weather in 2019?
I think it's always a little bit of a challenge. You know, what people expect and what's realistic, you know, people want that 10-day forecast or that 7-day forecast. And, you know, really, if you talk to meteorologists, you know, because that's the big joke, right? You know, they're never right. Well, going that many days out can really be a challenge, right. You know, and so I think that's probably the number one challenge. But when it comes to severe weather, you know, I distinctly remember the July storms. I mean, we were on the air for hours and hours Friday night, and then we were right back at it Saturday morning because some had fired all back up again. And so sometimes just that staying power is difficult, and trying to track and keep it interesting for the viewers, but not too complicated.
You know? I mean, behind the scenes, just this is a little bit of a diversion, but, you know, it's always amazing to me when a meteorologist can be on the air and keep talking about things. Are they getting a lot of support? Are there others in the station? Are some of the news people helping with that? What kind of support are they getting to keep current information out there while staying on the air?
They are. Typically, you know, we have a team that's helping, whether it's just a fellow meteorologist. They're at WEAU, their office, if you will, is actually in the studio. So all of the equipment, all of the alerts, all of the weather information is coming in right literally feet from where they're standing on the air. So accessibility is a really big thing. It's not quite back in the old days where, you know, you ripped the warning off of the AP machine and had to literally hand the piece of paper. But there's still some of that goes on.
Yes, there is.
And I was just going to say, kind of the new technology drone thing, one thing that I've noticed local TV stations doing is, you know, if they're not live on the air, they're doing Facebook live video. And that's been really nice for myself, like trying to determine, okay, how, you know, big is it, you know, planning my coverage.
And that's been a challenge for us in the media too, because as we all know, as something new gets quote invented, you know, first it was just television, that was our focus. Well, then there was this invention called the internet. So then we all had websites to manage. Well, now it's social media and it's Facebook and it's Twitter and it's Instagram. And, you know, you can kind of lose your mind a little bit if you know, trying to keep track of all those different things.
Well, you've all become multimedia reporters. You really have.
Right. Definitely.
Gary Johnson, before we get off the topic of weather, and then we'll go to break, two of the top four stories in the Leader Telegram's list of top stories for 2019 dealt with weather. That summer's storm damage was number four. Number two was our record snowfall in February, and of course that big April snowstorm, too, that postponed the growing season a little bit. it was a brutal one last winter. When do these individual weather stories start to expand to a broader issue of climate?
Yeah, I mean, it's the snow, you know, nothing is more important around here, certainly in the winter, as what's going to happen with the weather, the snowfall, you know. What's the weather? I'm looking ahead to see what's going to be like for the Packer game on Sunday.
Absolutely. Everybody is.
You know, my children live 3 hours away from here. If they're coming home for the weekend, what's the weather going to be like? Do they have to leave on Friday or Saturday or Sunday? When you get snow like that, it's a really big story when it comes 6 inches after 6 inches after 8 inches. He goes on forever. But, yeah, certainly I think looking forward, we'll see. Is this a trend? Is this, you know, was that an anomaly this last year? Probably not. You know, I guess we'll see. I mean, this time last year, this is about the amount of snow we had. And then come February and you get whatever it was, 53 inches yep. in one short month. So
that was the voice of Gary Johnson. He's the editor of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram. Also joining us for this hour is Lisa Patro, news director of Channel 13 in Eau Claire, and Rich Kramer of Wisconsin Public Radio's office in Eau Claire. So what do you think? What's the big story from 2019? Your comments and questions, welcome now at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbeck. You're tuned to the West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back on the West Side. We're reviewing the year 2019 and looking ahead to the year 2020. With Western Wisconsin journalists Lisa Patro, Gary Johnson, and Rich Kramer. Weather stories, we kind of ended with that in the last hour. Weather stories weren't the only environmental stories that made the 2019 lists in Western Wisconsin. There's a push to get local governments to become less dependent on fossil fuels, and Lisa Patro, the city of Eau Claire, was among those to pledge a zero carbon footprint by 2050. Is this a trend you expect to continue?
I think so. I think that there's a push not only nationally for this type of thing, but I think it's something that, you know, as a public, as a whole, we've just become more and more conscientious of our impact on the environment, something that's, you know, started with, you know, 30 years ago with recycling yeah. and, you know, that kind of thing and just yeah. keeps
Earth
progressing
Day.
And progress. Right.
Back
Earth Day, all those kinds 70. Of things. You know, I know that they've made some, you know, modifications. I know they, you know, with streetlights and things like that in the city of Eau Claire. But, you know, I think it's a challenge because financially sometimes it is more expensive to be environmentally conscious. So you have to kind of figure out, you know, when it comes to taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
How do we best manage that?
What's the balance? Gary Johnson, there seems to be increasing examples of local governments considering resolutions on broader issues of our day, whether that's gun control or school choice, which is actually the latter came up at an Eau Claire County Board meeting this last week. Is this a new trend or is this something we've seen through the years where local government tries to have a voice on issues that they may not actually be able to manage directly?
Well, I think it's probably been around for a while, but it's probably just stepped up a little bit more in recent years, you know, because there's so many national issues that I think a lot of local governments feel it's their responsibility. You'll see a real split on some of these bodies, though. I mean, there's definitely a group that is for that and certainly others that are not. I mean, the city council has been a good example of that over the years. Some people think, if flat out said, we shouldn't be getting involved in this. And others say, well, no, this is our responsibility as leaders in this city, in this county. We should be stepping forward and telling people where we should be going.
Yeah, I moderated a debate of the city council candidates last year, and that was kind of a big issue that there are some people who saw it as a platform for talking about larger issues. Others said, hey, manage the city, and right. that'll continue to be a conversation, I'm sure. Our topic is big stories of 2019 and what you expect the big stories of 2020 to be. 800-228-5615 is the number for you to join. Our phone lines are open. Mort Cypress at the board, ready to take your call. Back to stories that relate to both the environment and the local economy. Sand mining certainly has been a top 10 issue for the decade, infusing a lot of money into the area while making others nervous about the ecological impacts of mining. Rich Kramer, you've been on the sand mining beat from WPR throughout. In fact, you just had a report on the news this morning about the state of mining in western Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's very kind of speculative in nature. I mean, as in, I spoke to...
That's what we're doing this hour. We're speculating.
I spoke with one of my analysts that I reach out to. These are people that... They don't just look at frac sand mining. They look at what's called E&P services or the E&P industry. And that is energy producers, you know, companies that are drilling. But what I'm more interested in is how much sand or what is called proppant they're using and what the demand is for all of that. So, you know, in the way back, you know, 2011 through, say, 2015, there was just incredible growth of the sand mining industry in Wisconsin. Then it kind of crashed in 16 and kind of rebounded a little bit in 17, 18. But then this industry started to shift. Wisconsin sand from in the early days was considered top, the strongest, the highest quality. Everybody wanted it. So that's what really fueled the growth of the industry. Since 2017 and mostly 2018, energy producers specifically in Texas and what's called the Permian Basin, which is the most busy oil field area, they realized that they could just dig any old sand that was located within 50 miles, and it got the same results. So very quickly, you saw the demand for what's called Northern White, that's our brand of frac sand, just fall off the face of the earth. And it still is supplying places like North Dakota or Pennsylvania, New York, you know, the natural gas fields over there. But the hottest oil drilling region is using about 85%, what I'm told, of the local sand, which means Wisconsin producers have lost a lot of market share. So last year we saw a lot of closures, high crush operation in Whitehall shut down basically for the whole year. Covia, which is used to be called Fairmont Santrol, over in Dunn County, and they've got other operations. They've idled operations. I think they mainly supply the glass factory in Menominee now. But just a lot of closures, and of course we saw Superior Silica Sands, which used to be one of the preeminent players in Wisconsin, declared bankruptcy, and it's going through a real messy situation right now. Chippewa County is saying that they owe us some more money for reclamation costs, and the company is basically saying, get in line, we owe over $200 million, so... that is going to be something to watch. To me, it seems like, because that's been one of the big questions, is what happens if these mines, when they shut down, either because they're done mining or the bottom falls out. So I think this is kind of a test case, and we're going through it right now.
And Gary Johnson, we do have a history of a mine successfully kind of reclaiming the copper mine up in Russ County. Very controversial, while I'm sure not everybody who opposed the mine was satisfied with the result, that area did get reclaimed. But this reclamation problem in Chippewa County that Rich is alluding to, that presents some political problems as well as economic problems.
Right. You know, and I think anybody who drives around is not just Chippewa County. I grew up around Whitehall. You drive between Whitehall and Blair, and just the landscape has just changed. I mean, on Highway 53 there, it's not what it used to look like, you know, back in the day. So all those reclamation projects are going to have to happen, and it's going to make things look very different. You could see, as Rich said, you know, get in line. Whenever you see situations like this, everybody's not going to get paid, and we'll see where the counties end up.
I think that's what has made it controversial, too, and, you know, the truck traffic and all those kinds of things, because mining is really nothing new. Mining in Wisconsin, you know, since...
What's a badger?
Right, you know, what's a badger?
The badger isn't the animal, it's the miner.
It's the miner. Yeah. So it's nothing new, moving the earth, and reclamation efforts, have been highly successful, I think, for the most part, up until this point. I think that's where the environment and the sand particles and those sorts of things. But, you know, those didn't seem to be hot button issues.
Not broadly.
Previously. Not broadly. Even though mining was, broadly done.
Yeah.
And I want to jump in, too, because there are a handful of companies that have been around for like 100 years. You've got Badger Mining, which is down in Jackson County and that area of the state. And they have reclaimed sites. And I'm sure there's debate on whether it's considered successful or not. But it can be done. And Chippewa County has been really kind of ahead of the game, too, because they enlisted the help of researcher Holly Dolliver at UW River Falls to take a look at the Superior Silica sand mines. I mean, they didn't know that this was going to go bankrupt, but they did a study to find what the best kind of plants to use, the best approaches to reclaiming the site. So it's not a brand new thing, but the fact that this conversations happening in Chippewa County because of a bankruptcy and not because the mining is finished its operations. That's what makes everything very interesting, because every county asks for money ahead of time to set aside in case the company goes bankrupt. Chippewa County said that they don't have enough. They're fighting over an additional $1.6 million. So,
but that's a good point, actually, with the reclamation efforts, because, you know, what was it before when they started? Was it, you know, poison ivy, and, you know, what was growing there, and how can we reclimate it using the native grasses or the mm-hmm. milkweed? You know, we talk about the bees and the butterflies and, you know, the impact that the lack of native grasses is having on them. So that's a really good point. How do we, if we are going to dig into the ground and then reclimate it later, how can we reclimate it in a way that makes it better than it was before we started?
Yeah, and that's one of the things they were looking at. They were actually, some of these areas were kind of timber, you know, the trees had covered it over, very thin soils, which is why these companies are interested, because the sandstone that they want is right under the surface. But so in Chippewa County at the Superior Silica, they planted a lot of native prairie. I mean, they spent a lot of money.
I think a lot of people are aware of the sand mines because they're so visible. In the town of Grant up in Russ County, when that Flambeau Mining Company, that was kind of stuck off. You know, people didn't see that a lot. Where now, if you drive north on 53, all of a sudden,
Auburn.
Boom, there it is.
Yeah.
And people are like, boy, people who don't think about the sand industry, every time they take that highway, they think about it.
Or the hundreds of rail cars there, or the miles of rail cars if you go up by Spooner.
Right.
Willem from Colfax has joined us, and I don't exactly know what Willem wants to talk about, but I know he's talked to us in the past about sand mining. Is that your topic today, Willem?
Yes.
Go for it.
Well, I remember attending many meetings about proposed mines, like the proposed mine, what's called the Albertville Valley Mine, 1,200 acres, and what the person said before about mining in Wisconsin, the Badger State, all that is true, but never on this scale. Never has there been mining in Wisconsin that has literally changed the landscape forever. And this idea of reclamation, I remember attending a reclamation meeting for this mine, and they were actually posting images of English gardens and talking about reclamation. And I think the problem with this reclamation fantasy is that it's never going to be restored to what it was. So people should put that out of their mind, that somehow, and they even said it was going to be better than before, which I find, you know, that's just fantastical. And the problem is with this reclamation is that there's no real money. It's like bonds that can be terminated within a 90-day notice, and where is the money and where is the reclamation? Like other mines in Chippewa County, you can see them from the observation tower at Hoffman Hills. That view will never be restored. It's supposedly reclaimed. It looks like a big mound that's painted green. I mean, that's hardly what we have now. So reclamation is a fantasy. There's no money. We knew that at the time, and we would tell the county officials, and we were always assured that, oh, no, this is money, it's bonded, it's set aside. It's just a fantasy. It's not happening. They're never going to get the money from these companies because the companies just dissolve and they disappear. So this is, it's not true that, you know, Wisconsin is a mining state. Never like this, never on this scale. Like you said, around what's happening in Blair and that area when you drive around there, it's an obscenity.
Thank you, Willem. Rich Kramer, any thoughts on, did the county officials turn a deaf ear to those who were warning that this is the very thing that could happen?
Well, that's, you know, that's up for debate. But the what happened was the growth of this industry was just so happened so fast. Before, when I first started looking at sand mining, it was because someone was killed at the Emerge Energy. The one in Chippewa Falls, I can't even think of it. It used to be Canadian Sand and Proppants. Now it's EOG Resources. They were building the factory, the big sand plant. A wall collapsed on someone, and it killed them. I had never heard of sand mining before that, frac sand mining. And then over the next 3 or 4 years, well, since, it's been one of the major issues that I've covered. And I went to a lot of these county board meetings where they were talking about approving these sand mines. And the companies... You know, you saw a pattern. The companies would kind of, they would find this the deposits of sand that they wanted, and they would approach town boards. They would usually go to town boards that had three members. They would offer them big time. They would offer them money up front, or else they would say, "We'll give you 10 cents or 5 cents per ton." You know, the promises of millions of dollars, and they got these approvals. And they started. It took a few years for people that were concerned about sand mining to kind of mobilize, and for local governments to kind of start questioning this. But by the time the resistance to it really took hold, we had gone from like 7 to 70 facilities, and now the DNR, they don't really know for sure, but still over 100, what I'm told, sand mining facilities, not just mines, but mines processing, etc.
Sand mining, one of the big stories of 2019 and really for the past decade, and I would guess would be one of those stories we continue to talk about in 2020. Our guests today, three journalists from Western Wisconsin, Rich Kramer from Wisconsin Public Radio, Gary Johnson from the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram, Lisa Patro from TV 13. Our topic is the year past and the year ahead and what we're looking forward to. Still time for you to join the conversation at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach. This is the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you're tuned to the West Side. We're talking about the big stories of 2019 and the ones we expect for 2020. Lisa Patro from TV 13, Rich Kramer from Wisconsin Public Radio, and Gary Johnson from the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram are here with us. You're welcome to join the call at 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Another economic story that's big in western Wisconsin is the continuing difficulty local farmers are having. The late spring certainly had an impact, but there are other factors like federal tariffs that the farmers can't control. Lisa Patro, what's been the biggest change you've noticed through the work that your team has done this past decade when it comes to agriculture in western Wisconsin?
I think one of the biggest challenges that farmers face right now is, you know, the tariffs, certainly, and the fact that it's very difficult to just switch crops. So, you know, soybeans, if you're not getting what you need, or corn, you know, you can't just start growing potatoes. It doesn't work that way because all of the equipment now is so diversified. It's so crop specific that it's just very expensive in order to change. So I think we're seeing more collaboration than we used to maybe in the past amongst family farms and family farmers, you know, kind of going back to the barn raising days of the past where people would gather and help their neighbors. And then I think farmers became much more independent. And now I think we're seeing more of that collaboration of when it comes to diversifying their farms or attempting to.
Yeah, a report released this morning shows that there were 776 fewer farms in Wisconsin at the end of 2019 than at the beginning, and I'll credit Scott Schultz over at Midwest Family Stations. I heard that on his report this morning. That's a loss of 100 more farms than we lost during 2018. Gary Johnson, you know, you cover farm issues in the Leader-Telegram, and of course your sibling newspaper, The Country Today, is based here in Eau Claire. How is that changing the economic landscape of western Wisconsin to see these farms, the number of farms continuing to decline?
I mean, I think it's always been a tough way to make a living. My parents were dairy farmers. My brother, all three of my brothers were farmers at one time or another. And they no longer are. It's a tough way to make a living. There used to be every farm up a coulee, up a road, had farms along every side of the road. And now you'll see maybe one, if any at all, you know, like in Jackson County where I grew up on a farm. And it's been really hard on farmers. I mean, we've written so many stories about, we were discussing earlier, Lisa, about mental health issues, farmers' mental health issues. I mean, for a long time, it's like, you know, they were the stoic rural people, farmers who didn't talk about their feelings, and it's been really hard on them. And now you'll see a lot more groups. There's been a lot of meetings that, like down the Durand area where farmers need to talk about what's going on in their lives. I mean, you know, the seriousness, you know, the possibility of suicide and things like that. It's just, you know, it's a really, really difficult time for farmers. But I mean, these are strong people, and you'll see young people. We've done stories about them who say, you know, I will continue this generational farming. And hopefully it does continue like that.
But some of them don't. And I think that's where a lot of times that emotion comes in where, right. You know, it was great grandpa's farm and then it was grandpa's and then it was dad's. And then kind of almost losing part of your heritage.
You've let somebody down.
Yeah, you've let somebody down or we weren't. Yeah, a guilt to it. And I think that's where that mental health can come into play. But it's just not sustainable or maybe, you know, there's fewer kids these days amongst the families. And so maybe there aren't the children who want to take over the farm. And I think it gets tough.
And I mean, the number of farms is decreasing big time, but the average size of the farms are getting much bigger. And not long ago, last fall, I was in Grantsburg. This was because of an initiative that the University of Wisconsin System put forward, the Dairy Hub Initiative, where they're trying to put a bunch of money into research to figure out different products that you can get from milk and different ways to help farmers. And to kind of highlight that program, they held the event at a dairy farm that was owned by one of the regents. And this was a totally automated facility. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the large, you know, I've seen the big milking carousels, and they're quite a thing to see in person, you know, 1,000 cows, and they're out of, but this was totally robotic. The cows just went to one corner of their little pen area, and the robot like washed them, and it just did everything. And you know, the regent told me that they had let go 10 people because of that technology, and it was just something else to witness. And of course, that brings into the growing size of these farms also contributes to a big issue is groundwater contamination from, you know, nitrates and fecal coliform bacteria, et cetera.
Yeah, the managing of the manure is continuing to be an ecological and environmental issue that is being dealt with state and locally. 800-228-5615, your number to join us. Vern from Boyd has joined us. Vern, welcome to the West Side.
I'm against, against single crops. We should not be trading farm goods to China because it's not economical. We need factories. And like I said, when you plant single crops, it's not good for the soil, and you got, you know, specific machines, whatever. They're not high-value crops, and the mileage you got to ship them, it's just not in our national interest. Plus, farming is number one or two greenhouse gas generator. We got to get out of farming to the extent we're in farming. We do, you know, if we ship grapes from the West Coast, that's different. But when we're shipping stuff down to Mississippi, you know, over to China, and we have subsidized farms besides, so how cheap are the Chinese actually getting this food for? You know, if it actually, you know, we're subsidizing communist China. I'm against almost any trade with China. It's not in our national interest.
Thank you, Vert. So the tariffs with China, not a bad thing from that perspective if it's reducing trade, but I know that there are a lot of farmers in western Wisconsin who have been relying, especially soybeans, that sort of thing, have been relying on China for a trade partner. But yeah, with political tensions, and as long as we're talking political tensions, there's a big election in 2020. Mm. Lisa Patra, I expect you're gearing up to see some presidential candidates in the spring.
We are. And in fact, actually today, as part of our election coverage, we're actually in Milwaukee, where, of course, the DNC is going to be held in July. And today is kind of a walkthrough and a preliminary kind of what to expect. And but yeah, definitely anticipate seeing candidates stop in Eau Claire, La Crosse, Western Wisconsin. Hopefully not on the same day as we experienced at that one a few years ago.
Yeah, and then, of course, the fall election. Wisconsin's going to a big bellwether state, I don't think we'll have a situation where one of the party's candidates decides not to come this year. Gary Johnson, how does that play into, you know, not only your coverage of the presidential election, but all of that presidential politics has an effect on the local legislative elections that will be happening concurrently in the fall?
Sure. You can tag along, you know, on somebody's coat strings, you know, for you look at past elections. I mean, absolutely, we are going to see presidential candidates on Fridays, on Saturdays, on Sundays as we get to the primary, and then again in November. And the state legislature will be interesting as well. I mean, you have, you know, all the representatives up again. All the assembly members will be up. This region, you know, has historically, you know, it's fairly split right now with Democrats and Republicans. But it's just really hard to believe that they can't work a little better together instead of, you know, a little more across the aisle. I mean, obviously, with a Democratic governor and GOP controlling the both houses, we're at a stalemate right now.
Well, that was one big change in 2019 was the swearing in of a new governor. Democrat Tony Evers took over for Scott Walker. Marked the first time in 8 years in which Republicans didn't have the governorship and a majority of both houses of the legislature. Now, they still have the legislature, but with the Democrat in power. Lisa Patra, how has that divided government affected us here in western Wisconsin?
Well, I think Gary hit on something when, you know, they don't seem to be working together very efficiently. And you see some of the stories that have come out in the last couple of months or the last even couple of weeks, states surrounding us, minimum wage, all those states that raise the minimum wage, Wisconsin, you know, remains at $7.25, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, you know, they're all higher, and we're kind of surrounded by that. And that's not the first time they've done it. And we've still stayed at $7.25. You look at marijuana, medical or otherwise, all the states that have taken action of some sort, Wisconsin continue red flag laws, something else that came up that Wisconsin also talks about, but there's been little movement on that. Meanwhile, it's been implemented in other states. So I think what's going to be interesting to see is the platform some of these candidates run on. You know, what are they interested in pursuing? So I think it'll be interesting.
Rich Kramer, the leadership seems to be much more involved than I remember, and I've been doing this now for 40-some years, and it seems like it used to be, and maybe I'm imagining this, but it seems like if an issue, let's say red flag laws, that's an example, Governor Evers called a special session on gun control in the fall. There are some gun control may be too strong an issue, but there are gun restriction or gun safety check issues that have been proposed by Republican legislators in our area. They don't even get a hearing. In fact, that special session lasted less than a minute before it was dismissed by the head of the legislative body. So, you know, what's the answer to that? Is it simply you have to elect all one party, or is there a way to get these folks working together? Rich Kramer, any examples that you've seen that look hopeful?
Well, I mean, every year, every session, there are bills where there's bipartisan support, and lawmakers on both sides especially the party in power, will point to, look at all these bills we did. Well, it's generally naming a highway or something. Those are the kind of bills where they work together. When Tony Evers was elected, I thought, oh my, I don't even know how to cover state government anymore, because ever since I've been at WPR, it's been one-party control. So I thought, oh, we're going to see a lot of bipartisanship. Well, then the Republicans in the legislature basically neutered Evers to some extent. Like they took away some of his powers. So that was kind of a bellwether. And you're right, it is very top down now in terms of the state leadership in the assembly and the Senate.
Let me throw out one example, and it touches on an issue that we all agreed is probably a quiet issue that's lurking beneath the surface, but is really a major issue, and that's mental health. Last summer, State Senator Kathy Bernier of Chippewa Falls, State Senator Patty Shockner of Somerset, one a Republican, one a Democrat, had sort of competing bills relating to ways to spend money on mental health care. It has since, and we just had the two of them on this this program in the past month, and they have come together to support, you know, Senator Bernier's bill to develop some beds here in Eau Claire County. So that's an example of at least working across the aisle from two individuals. Does that sort of bipartisanship on a regional basis have an opportunity to be successful in Madison, Gary Johnson, for that particular issue or for others?
I would sure hope so. I mean, because when you talk about that topic, when it didn't go anywhere in the legislature, it was because it depended on whose bill it was. If you didn't sponsor it, you don't vote for it. If your party doesn't sponsor it, you don't vote for it, which makes no sense. I mean, we should be talking, you know, certainly these regional lawmakers should be getting together and say, whether Republican or Democrat or independent, and saying, okay, here's what's good for the region. Here's what we really need these beds, or we really need this to help agriculture out. We should be working together, you know, these eight lawmakers to make things happen instead of saying, well, no, it's got to be an R or a D next to it.
Right, because these should not be partisan issues. Mental health is not a party issue. It is a public issue, and it affects communities all across Western Wisconsin. And I completely agree. This is the time for collaboration is on these types of issues, because, you know, from birth to death, we are seeing mental health as a problem.
And Rich Kramer, you're reporting early in the year, or, you know, in the spring, I believe, from the UW Board of Regents, that mental health, particularly a problem on college campuses, and here in Western Wisconsin, just a very difficult access to mental health care, that there are counties in our region, where there is not a psychiatrist in the county.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a huge issue, and that was part of the UW's push. I mean, they identified that like roughly 50%, or the need for counseling on the college campus has increased by 50% recently. And meanwhile, the number of counselors has not followed suit. So they also looked at it in terms of, well, maybe we can use the university counselors to help with the communities, you know, especially in rural areas that just don't have these. It's a huge issue, and one that will be discussed for a long time.
That's the voice of Rich Kramer of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us, Rich. Lisa Patro from Channel 13 was with us as well. And Gary Johnson from the Eau Claire Leader Telegram. I want to mention, Gary Johnson, 10 seconds, you've got a commemorative issue coming up. Tell us more about that.
Yes, it's going to be looking forward to briefly back to the last decade and forward to the next decade. You know, 2020 vision, agriculture, business, some prognosticators saying what they think might happen in the coming 10 years.
And that's in Sunday's paper, I think, on the 26th of January.
That's correct.
Gary Johnson of the Eau Claire Leader Telegram. Thanks to our guests today. Thanks for Catherine Thomas for producing the West Side. Welcome back, Mort Cypress, for taking our on-air calls today. Thanks also to Kate Spranger for getting the word out about today's show. Next week, the issue of voter registration will be our focus, particularly coming after last month's court decisions instructing the state to eliminate a number of local voter records. We'll also preview the Martin Luther King holiday. I'm Dean Kallenbach. You're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.